Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Captain Morgan Sliced. Since the dawn of bread, people have known the truth. Sliced is better. That's why new Captain Morgan Sliced went all in on four bold, deliciously sliced cocktail-style flavors. Pineapple Daiquiri, Strawberry Margarita, Mango Mai Tai, and Passion Fruit Hurricane. Visit CaptainMorgan.com to find Sliced near you. Does not contain real fruit or juice. Captain Morgan & Co., Plainfield, Illinois. Please drink responsibly. 21 plus only.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I will be your host for today's discussion. And I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Jared Hoare. Dr. Hoare is a postdoctoral fellow and is the co-director at the New Earth Histories Research Program at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and is the author of the book we'll be discussing today, Visions of Nature, How Landscape Photography Shaped Settler Colonialism, which came out with the University of California Press just a little bit earlier this year in 2022. Welcome to the New Books Network, Jared. Good to have you.
Thanks very much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Why don't we begin, as we always do on the New Books Network, by just hearing a little bit about you as an author. Tell us about yourself and about how you became interested in history.
Yeah, so I did history as an undergraduate at Macquarie University in Sydney. And I think I got particularly interested in history for its kind of environmental aspects. So I'm an environmental historian. And I first got interested in history via a kind of, rich Australian tradition of thinking about the colonial past through a kind of environmental lens. I'm talking here about scholars like Tom Griffiths, Grace Karskens, Ian Tyrrell. And to me, I thought that this form of history writing and thinking about the environment and thinking about colonialism helped understand a lot of the kind of political aspects, a lot of the political problems, that is, with landscapes, with wilderness, with preservation, that we kind of confront today.
Gotcha. And so my next question, which you kind of touched on a little bit just then, is I'm wondering how you got interested in the topic of this book specifically. What brought you to these questions about landscape photography and specifically about photographers from the late 19th and early 20th century?
Yeah, it was actually biography, funnily enough, that got me interested in the topic of the book. I got quite interested in a Tasmanian photographer called John Watt Beattie, who was a very successful landscape photographer in the late 19th century in Tasmania, which has its own kind of troubled and kind of grim colonial past. And I got really interested in the series of images that this guy, John Watt Beattie, made of the beautiful Tasmanian highlands, which are still a kind of really important site for wilderness tourism today. But also all of the other things that John Beattie photographed. He photographed Indigenous people on missions in Tasmania and in Bass Strait. He photographed evidence and the kind of ruins of the convict establishments in Tasmania, where people were moved and detained in the early years of that colony. And I think what I got interested in particular, were how these images related to one another and what kind of visual universe, you know, it meant to have a photographer who was taking photos of all of these different things, all of these different aspects of colonial society. What it meant that some of these images were more popular than others. These images were categorized in different ways. And to me, this became like a big kind of problem that I wanted to solve, which, you know, made me have to look at other colonies as well as Tasmania. I started with Tasmania, and then I ended up having to ask some questions like, what did the settler revolution look like? What does settler colonialism look like? And I think the best way to answer that, you know, in the late 19th century is to think comparatively, to look at somewhere like California, to look at Victoria, just north of Tasmania in southern Australia, to look at New Zealand, and to compare the kind of different images, these different visual universes that emerged in each of these places.
Well, and I have to ask, are you a photographer yourself, or did the process of writing this book maybe turn you into a photographer at all?
Maybe. it's kind of interesting. I think, you know, it certainly made me more interested in photography than what I was at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that photographs, you know, are in general, or can be anyway, an underused kind of source for historians. And one of the things that I want to do in this book, and that I'm trying to do in my work overall, is to, you know, take photographs more seriously and pay the attention to photographs as kind of artifacts, as sources, the same kind of attention that we might pay to, you know, to written works, to letters, to correspondence, to journals, to those different types of sources. So, you know, definitely, it has made me more interested in photography. I've become much more interested in the kind of aesthetics of, you know, the aesthetics of environments. But I wouldn't call myself a photographer, you know, in a general sense.
Well, let's get into the book a bit. And I want to start with a definition. Can you give us a kind of, and this is not an easy question to ask, but kind of a quick definition of what exactly settler colonialism is, just in case any of our listeners are not familiar with the concept?
You're right that it's not an easy task. I think like the easiest kind of definition or the easiest way to think about it is that settler colonialism is a, you know, a particular type of colonialism, you know, that functions through the replacement of indigenous populations with an invasive settler society. It's, you know, I think most people will, a lot of your listeners will know that it's best theorized still, I think, by Patrick Wolfe, defined by, you know, those great phrases that Patrick developed in the 1990s and 2000s, defined by a logic of elimination, you know, that settlers come to stay, that settler colonialism's a structure, not an event. I still think those are the kind of best expressions of what settler colonialism is and means. But I suppose, you know, in this work and in my work more generally, I'm trying to, you know, mix in an attention to the environmental aspects of this structure of settler colonialism, I might say. And, you know, maybe thinking about defining settler colonialism as an environmental process. The Australian author Paul Carter wrote about surveying and about settler spatiality. It's about trying to create a place where the imagination might be enticed to settle. And I think, you know, outside of the very clear kind of definitions of settler colonialism, that's the kind of general idea about settler colonial culture or about settler colonial processes that I'm trying to kind of accentuate most in this book. I'm trying to think about how settlers made places or conveyed places or photographed places in a way that enticed imaginations to settle.
And settler colonialism was imposed upon different places and different people all over the world. You know, over the course of the 18th and 19th and into the 20th centuries, and of course as an ongoing structure into the 21st century as well. But as you said before, with that point in mind, this is a comparative work. And in the book, you're looking at landscapes and environments and landscape photography and photographers in places all over the world, in a few different places. So what are some of the locations that you cover in this book, and why did you choose those places specifically?
Yeah, I think like this, I think this relates a little bit to your comment, about settler colonialism as a kind of, process or as a an imposition on different peoples and places all over the world. One reason why I chose the locations in this book, which are, the American West more broadly, but California specifically, and what I kind of refer to as the Tasman world, which is the cluster of colonies around the Tasman Sea, Victoria, Tasmania, New South Wales, and New Zealand. The reason why I chose those two sites is because these are the two, most successful settler colonies of the late 19th century. After the gold rushes in the 1850s, settlers in these places kind of create a very assertive, very confident way of thinking about land and thinking about their settlement there. And I think with my questions, about settlement and settler colonialism and about environmental changes especially, examining them in these sites is really important, because this is where those environmental changes were most accentuated. This is where, I might say settlement has been, settler colonialism has been most permanent and most successful. And so again, though, this also means that this is where the political problems of settler colonialism, specifically the displacement and dispossession of Indigenous people, this is where those political problems remain kind of crucial questions. So a lot of the places that I write about in the book, the photographers are based in cities. So we're talking about places like Dunedin in Otago. We're talking about Melbourne, San Francisco, Hobart. And some of these cities are some of the most successful, fastest growing places in the world at this time. This is something that James Bellich has explored in detail, calls it explosive colonialism, in which population growth is rapid. There's a huge amount of movement between Europe and places like California and Australia, and between the eastern United States and California. There's also a kind of movement of people, and I will say also photographs, around these places in the late 19th century. The other interesting, or I suppose the other important reason why I've considered California and this Tasman world, is because there was quite a substantial interchange of people, ideas, and technologies between those two places across the Pacific in the late 19th century.
I recently had May Nye on the book, the historian at Columbia University, to discuss her latest book on Chinese emigration around the Pacific world and around settler colonial societies. And she's also making similar connections between, say, gold rushes, for instance, in Australia and in the American West. So it sounds as though this kind of comparative work between Australia and the West, this is kind of having a moment right now in the field. It sounds like you're very much at the center of that.
That's very kind of you to say. I think, scholars wrote about this, in the 1990s and early 2000s mm-hmm. as well. I think it's interesting to kind of return to and ask why that's the case. I think that was very much a kind of transnational moment in the 1990s. I think this moment is possibly maybe a little bit more comparative, still transnational, but I suppose the questions, are a bit different in this case. Yeah.
This is a book that's, as much as it's about photographs and it's about landscapes and it's about environment and it's about large, you know, very real but also very theoretical ideas like settler colonialism, it's also a book that's about people. And there are photographers at the heart of the story that you tell. So let's talk a bit about some of the characters who play important roles in this book. And early on in the book, in Visions of Nature, you describe what you call six geobiographies, which I thought was a really useful term. Geobiographies of important landscape photographers from, broadly speaking, around the turn of the 20th century. So can you explain what you mean by geobiography, what a geobiography is exactly, and how that idea pertains to these individuals?
Yeah. I'm probably trying to be a bit cute with the term, you know, in the way that historians sometimes do.
I liked it. It was effectively cute, if that's the case.
But, you know, I think wordplay is important. And I said before that I've been interested in biography for quite a while. And so when I was putting, you know, this book together, I wanted to think about life writing, obviously biography, but also earth and life writing, you know, as an environmental historian. So I wanted to, you know, I use this term because I'm trying to, you know, make it help me focus on the way that these settlers came to identify with the places they ended up, and how they kind of, you know, how their work fed into a process where other people came to identify with these places. Notably, five of these six photographers that I deal with, and I'll go through them in a minute, settled permanently despite kind of moving around in the places that they settled to. And so I think this term helps us recognize the connections that bound settler image makers and colonial places together. But it also reminds us that these photographers never just kind of, you know, conjured these visions out of thin air. That they drew them from a vast network of people who were also working intimately with places. You know, these are scientists, writers, thinkers. They were native guides often, even the physical places themselves. And so these ties, I think, between these kind of like settled settler networks are preserved, and physical places are preserved in the photographs that are produced in this period. And there are kind of environmental attitudes encoded in them as well. But I think in the end that geobiography leads us to consider how these, you know, emerging senses of sight that come across through science, through landscape photography, through new environmental attitudes, they actually came to shape different lives. They certainly shaped the lives of these six settler photographers that I write about. So just to go through the photographers quickly, they're all men. You know, many of them are British. The first one was Daniel Mundy, and so he's a New Zealand photographer, born in Wiltshire in England, emigrates to New Zealand in 1864, begins working, you know, drawing from the capital, that gets unleashed in southern New Zealand during the gold rushes in Otago, to take photographs of landscapes and of people. He ends up moving to Sydney for a while in New South Wales, photographing in Sydney, and he ends up dying in 1881 in South Melbourne. Daniel Mundy is a kind of, you know, a neglected figure in New Zealand and Australian history. But the next one, you know, your readers will definitely know of, Carlton Watkins, born in 1829, he went on to New York, moves to California, has these connections with Collis Huntington, seems to be, you know, deeply involved with a whole series of important moments in the history of the American West. I also discuss Edwin Muybridge as a kind of complementary, you know, figure for Carlton Watkins. He's the one that doesn't end up finishing his life in the place that he settles in. Muybridge has, you know, as I'm sure your listeners will also know, a very kind of peripatetic career, moving all over the place. The other photographers, there's another New Zealander, Alfred Burton, who becomes famous for a trip that he makes into the Maori-controlled King Country in the 1880s. takes these amazing photographs, ethnographic photographs of the people who live in the King Country, but is also kind of instrumental in the way that Carlton Watkins was in taking photographs of the natural environment there just before it becomes highly valued by settlers as a wilderness and then becomes New Zealand's first national park. The other two photographers that I discussed at length are Australians. There are Nicholas Kerr, who's born in Guernsey, moves to Adelaide with his parents, and then ends up on the Victorian goldfields where he makes his career photographing goldfields development, but also photographing the forests and the mountains of Southeast Australia. And the final one's the photographer that got me interested in this project in the first place, John Beattie, who gets called the Prince of Landscape Photography in Australasia late in his career. But his family are Scots. He moves to Tasmania in 1878 and immediately starts taking photographs on the kind of, the high plateau of the interior of the island of Tasmania, which is probably the closest comparison in Australia anyway, to the kind of landscapes of the High Sierras. He also has a kind of peripatetic career. He stays in Tasmania, but he photographs in the Western Pacific. He develops Walter Munson's negatives of the trek to the South Pole in 1912. And has a lot of kind of really important, his photographs get taken up by the Tasmanian government in the 1920s and 30s. And his imagery becomes the kind of centerpiece anyway of early efforts to communicate or to frame Tasmania as an important place of kind of wildlife, wilderness leisure. So those are the six photographers. Sorry for being a little bit, but going on a bit there.
That's fine. And, you know, all of them have, you know, are pretty fascinating characters and they all play an important role in the story. So it's all good. So those are the photographers themselves. So I want to ask a bit about the photography, and I've had other guests on who have written books about images, and it's always a little strange talking about images on an audio medium like this, but we'll do the best that we can. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about some of the photography itself, and specifically about the photography and the role that it played in late 19th century empire building, in late 19th century imperialism. So, for example, could you maybe explain a bit about the role of Watkins photography in shaping how settlers were perceiving places like Yosemite or Mount Shasta, or even more sort of built environment places like the Spanish missions in California? What's the connection between creation of settler knowledge and photography in the American West and in the Tasman world?
I suppose we can definitely start with Shasta and Yosemite. So in the 1860s and 1870s, one of the most useful audiences for Carlton Watkins's photography were scientists and surveyors. And this is a kind of a situation that would be familiar actually to all of the photographers that I discuss. They were all kind of at various times in their careers intimately bound up with survey work. And of course, you know, survey work was very important for all of these kind of emerging settler colonies in the late 19th century, measuring, categorizing, encountering, describing, communicating what actually the land, what the land held, and what the possibilities of the land were, was kind of core business for settler colonies. So in the 1860s and 70s, Carlton Watkins gets bound up with scientists and surveyors. He sells images of trees and of flora to botanists at Harvard and Yale, and images of landscapes and landforms to geologists. And so there's this flow of Carlton Watkins's photographs across America, but also across the world. They become kind of, you know, important objects in international exhibitions as well. So Watkins is quite involved with Josiah Whitney and William Brewer, and some of his photographs printed in the Yosemite book by the California Geological Survey. In 1870, he joins Clarence King's 40th parallel survey and climbs and photographs Mount Shasta with the survey party. And importantly, the newly encountered Whitney Glacier, which is the last remaining glacier in the American West, kind of settles a long-running, you know, debate amongst the scientists about glaciers in the American West. Later on, Watkins takes pictures for George Davidson's geodetic survey. You know, and there is, again, as I said, there are similar kind of situations across the, you know, the white settler colonial world at this stage. But the point is that this accrual of scientific knowledge about the American West and about different settler colonies also in the Tasman world, it helps settlers develop more effective conceptions of belonging. And, in, you know, in parts of this book anyway, I'm trying to show how closely photography was bound up in these processes. The California missions are slightly different. You know, Watkins is involved in the revival of the missions as a symbol of settler California in the late 1870s. And that, I think, you know, we know this is a kind of channeling of romanticism in landscape photography that Robin Kelsey has written about in the context of the American West, and the kind of invocation of different forms of ruin in that romantic turn. But I suppose what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to put this in comparative perspective. You know, Australian historians like Tom Griffiths have written about ruins and what ruins mean to settlers. In some ways, that's similar to what Kelsey is doing. But in other ways, the settler colonial politics of it, how it relates to that fact of Indigenous dispossession, is a bit more clearer in the Australian literature. But so putting these kind of images, you know, of the California missions on the one hand, of the kind of decaying convict infrastructure in Tasmania that John Beattie gets interested in, these become kind of convenient symbols for settlers who are sensitive to the depth of their own local histories. Sometimes they're anxious about the depth of their own local histories. So I think we can read this interest in the California missions, and also, you know, Muybridge takes photographs of similar kind of ruinous mission and church architecture in Central America as well. I think we can read these kind of images of damage and decay as ways that these photographers are trying to narrate and extend and to deepen settler territorial belonging. By making, you know, viewers witness to different forms of epochal change. Now, there is that in the images quite clearly, but in this book, I'm trying to relate that back to also, you know, forms of romantic painting. So we're talking in the American case, you know, well back into the imagery of people like Thomas Cole. In the Australian case, there's a number of romantic painters like Eugene Bon Gerard and Thomas Pigwinet, who, you know, their imagery is kind of on the wane in the late 19th century. And, you know, these photographs of ruins, but all the, so these kind of like moody photographs of landscapes that are kind of sometimes positioned alongside them, they kind of take up the romantic legacy, I argue, in these settler colonies.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, File a claim right on the State Farm mobile app and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Landscape photography and the work of these photographers in the book, you also link it to changing ideas about time, both time on a human time scale, on a human level of chronology, and on a much larger geologic time scale at the end of the 19th century. How was that the case? What is that link between time and image? And how did this linkage, how does it help to add legitimacy to settler claims to the land that they are in the process of dispossessing and claiming for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I got increasingly interested in over the course of this project. One of the things that settlers are very conscious of doing, as you know, we just discussed about the California missions, is establishing a kind of time depth to their occupation. In the 1870s, many of these settlers are only there, only in California quite recently. It's the same kind of situation in parts of Australia, certainly in Victoria. So this draws a little bit on Rebecca Solnit's work on Edwin Muybridge. She wrote that although landscape photography is clearly concerned with space, it's quite obvious what the spatial importance of landscape photography is. Rebecca Solnit argues that its deepest theme is time. Part of this is about the, exposure, that late 19th century, the time of exposure that photographers have to use to capture these images. But the other kind of thing that's really interesting about this comment is that it starts to relate this kind of, long story of landscape formation to these images. So I suppose in this book, I'm trying to connect this idea to recent work in deep history and settler colonial politics, which is very current in Australia. I argue that these landscape artists were influenced by the newly established timescales of 19th century stratigraphical geology. And how couldn't they be if they're spending all this time with surveyors and geologists as part of their work? But earlier, the revelation of deep time in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, it humbles, as we know, existing human-centered chronologies, and it alternatively positions the earth at the heart of history. And so, I think it's interesting to think about landscape photography in this context, in which, these images gained further temporal meaning as an expression or an impression of the physical archive of the earth's history. So, I'm trying in this case to read Carlton Watkins's or Edwin Muybridge's photographs of Yosemite, not just as this kind of declaration of this obvious spatial declaration of settler dominion, but a kind of temporal declaration as well. So each photographic image of landscape, it captures the physical symbols of time in space. There are hanging valleys, in the Yosemite that link waterfalls to a totally different past, a past under a glacier. There are the flat meadows, Yosemite Valley, also can be read then as the result of a kind of long process of glacial accretion. Dramatic landforms become this simple result of the operation of, as Charles Lyell said, the physical laws over vast periods of time. And so this is the case in somewhere like Yosemite, but it's also the case in somewhere like Milford Sound in southern New Zealand, a place that is quite obviously, marked by glacial action. It's also the place in kind of more prosaic topographies in Australia. Yeah. So I think, and maybe we might talk about this later, but I've become more and more interested in the history of geology and the history of the way that photography, in this case anyway, kind of articulates geological ideas.
So the photographs are, of course, they're about landscapes. And as you're saying, they're also geologic features as well. And part of that was, a lot of that was intentional, right? That the photographers here are trying to tell stories about this land that depopulates that land. Yet, despite that, all of the places that are discussed in the book, all the photographs that you show in the book, these are places that were, in fact, inhabited at the time that the photographs were taken. So then, why were these photographers attempting to show this land often as a depopulated place? And then, to kind of make a more broad question out of this, what role do Indigenous people play in the story that you tell here?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and this is key, and I think also this is, I suppose this is the agenda behind the Deep Time Scholarship that I was mentioning before. The purpose here, as I've said, is to reinforce settlement. You know, Indigenous presence is, you know, by its very fact, resistance. And I'm trying to read against, I suppose, some of the, you know, some of the obvious parts of this imagery, so to say, and to keep this resistance in mind, you know, as much as possible. So Lisa Ford's argued that in settler colonies, that the very presence of Indigenous people was an embarrassment to this new order that settlers were trying to construct. And so in colonial photography, I try and borrow, and this borrows a little bit from the ideas of Manu Karuga, I'm trying to discern a kind of like partition between these landscape images. I call it a visual partition between these landscape images and between images of Indigenous people that in many cases these photographers found it unavoidable to take photographs of Indigenous people. Yet the places that they were interested in for landscape reasons were depopulated, as you say. And so one thing that I explore in depth is this emergence of a kind of ethnographic portraiture, which is probably at its clearest, I think, in the King Country in New Zealand, which is a place that's highly valued for its kind of like mountain scenery. It's the site of Mount Tongariro, which became, as I said, New Zealand's first national park. But it's also one of the final kind of holdouts of the Maori people after the New Zealand Wars. And it's very clearly a place that is controlled when Alfred Burton travels there in the 1880s. By the Maori. And so in this site, and this is quite clear in the album of photographs that he composes, he takes photographs of Indigenous settlements, of Maori people, and then at certain points he kind of switches into a different mode entirely. And the photographs he takes are very clearly kind of landscape wilderness photographs. And I argue that, you know, the imagery that gets created in these contexts is actually quite disciplined. Photographers are good at discerning, you know, what they're taking photographs of and creating this visual partition. You know, a potential source, there's always this kind of, you know, possibility of fracture that kind of lurks behind these landscape images. And it's the continued endurance of Indigenous people in places like the Yosemite Valley in Northern California, where Muybridge takes photographs famously of the Murdoch War. It's in the Gippsland in Victoria and in the King Country in Northern New Zealand. And in these remote places, actually, which were otherwise highly valued by settlers as wildernesses, as agricultural frontiers or both, photographers turn their cameras away from the landscapes and onto very closely the Awanichi, the Modoc, the Gunai Kurnai, and the Kingitanga Maori. And as I say, this created a partition between, you know, landscape on the one hand and ethnographic portraiture on the other. And actually, I'm arguing in this case that settler belonging relied on the ways that these settler photographers organised images of Indigenous people into these genres, and how they depicted Indigenous presence in this case, in this limited case, according to, you know, stadial ideas about civilization. I argue, and this is, you know, possibly, you know, a provocative argument, but I argue that this innovation effectively sealed a spatial fantasy of settler colonialism, relying on the kind of, you know, the relying on the meanings, the objective kind of resonances of landscape photography in this moment. So photographically, wide expansion, it kind of proceeded over the topographies and geologies of the Tasman world and the American West, as its rightful owners were contained within these tightly framed portraits and these kind of conveniently placed reservations.
Yeah, it's about, you know, control, right? And these photographs are showing these people in these very kind of controlled environments. I think that is a provocative argument, but it's one that I certainly buy and that I took away from the book.
Mm. Yeah, and so, like in many cases, it's a myth.
Right, you know, of course. Like,
Muybridge is taking these staged photographs of, you know, of native people during the Murdoch War at the very moment that the Murdochs are, you know, quite successfully, you know, resisting settler control.
Right.
In the same moment that Alfred Burton's taking photographs of these kind of tightly contained people in the King Country. You know, the King Country is associated within popular memory in New Zealand as a dangerous place. It's a place where settlers are kidnapped and they are, you know, mm-hmm. taken prisoner by the Maori. And so, you know, I think it's actually, you know, it's important to kind of recognise that the work that this photography does in these moments, you know, and how it relates to the kind of, you know, how, I suppose, you know, how vulnerable probably actually certainly mm-hmm. settler colonialism was in those sites in those moments.
Mm-hmm. It's like you were saying before that these images are showing sort of the settler imagination, right? It's they're prescriptive rather than descriptive. They're what people, settlers at least, would want to see rather than what is actually going on in on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And that relates to their the fact that these photographs are consumer items as well. You know, we have to remember that the photographers are trying to sell their photographs.
right. So as much as these photographers are taking pictures of rural nature, right? That's the kind of classic landscape photography. That's a lot of what you cover in the book. That's not the whole story here either. Urban photography also plays an important role in creating the kind of settler stories that we were just talking about in Australia, in New Zealand, in the American West as well. Can you talk a little bit about how photographs of cities also told a kind of settler story about progress and about time and these kind of stories that that settlers wanted to hear told about themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. The best example of this, or the best examples of this are probably like kind of a series of, you know, urban panoramas that are taken in the 1870s. You know, I think the one that your listeners would be most familiar with is Edwin Muybridge's 1878 panorama of San Francisco, which is composed in the turret of Mark Hopkins's mansion on Nob Hill. And it provides this vision of San Francisco as a spectacular Western metropolis. You know, this panorama of Muybridge's was, you know, one of the crowning technical achievements of 19th century photography alongside Muybridge's other work photographing Leland Stanford's horse Occident, actually. And so panoramas are composed in this period. There are some of the Mississippi River, there's some, you know, depicting overland migration. And this kind of urban growth of San Francisco becomes one of the other central subjects of the panoramic gaze. Watkins attempts similar panoramas of the city in the 1860s, and other settlers use the technique to depict their own kind of booming metropolises. In the late 1870s, I suppose an investor and mine owner, Bernard Holtermann, after discovering, I think, one of the largest nuggets of gold ever discovered in central West New South Wales, he and a photographer, Charles Bayliss, take another panorama, but this time of Sydney, from the top of his mansion in North Sydney. And so this panorama gets exhibited at the Philadelphia Centennial in 1876, and then it goes to Paris to the Exhibition Universelle in 1878. And so these panoramas are used to kind of, you know, I think in one way anyway, they're used to communicate to settlers, you know, how, you know, how fast and how impressively these urban environments have developed and grown. Certainly the Sydney panorama is used by the New South Wales colonial government to promote emigration to Sydney. And the San Francisco panorama as well is this kind of, you know, this representation of urban growth, of sophistication, of the, you know, development of Western civilization, you know, so to say, in America. I think it's important to consider, you know, as we were saying just before, to consider the different aspects of settler photography in this period. So there is the, you know, the pictures of this kind of, you know, wilderness, absent nature, partitioned environments in which, you know, there are no people. There are these ethnographic portraits of Indigenous people. But also kind of complementing that are these images of urban environments and of urban development. And it's no mistake too that it's the panorama that is that develops as, you know, one of the most impressive and important ways of depicting urban environments in this period as well, because of the connotations that panoramas have, you know, the mastery over space, the kind of, you know, the total objective view that panoramas can kind of communicate. So of course, you know, the other interesting part about this is the way that panoramas get used and sent to these international exhibitions, which are themselves, you know, a result of a, you know, a high period of settler colonialism. You know, they're often sites where colonial symbolism, you know, you know, mobilised to their best effect, especially in Sydney and Melbourne in the 1870s and 80s. And, you know, the panoramas were some of the most popular attractions at these international exhibitions.
It goes back again to what we were talking about the settler imagination, right? That people are attending these exhibitions to, you know, learn about places in the world that they will likely never have a chance to visit themselves. And what kinds of stories about these places are they taking in? Well, they're taking in stories that are very carefully crafted by the photographers in question. So, you know, like you said, these are really important nodes of settler imagining. I want to return, as we begin to wrap up here, to the title of the book, because the title, or rather the subtitle, kind of has an implicit question in it: how landscape photography shaped settler colonialism. So as we reach the end of the interview, I'm wondering if you can attempt an answer there. What role did landscape photography play in shaping settler colonialism in the West and elsewhere?
Yeah. So the kind of argument that... the argument that I kind of, you know, want to advance, you know, with this book is essentially that landscape photography evened out inconsistencies in settler development. So, you know, we were talking about kind of, you know, the comparative moment in, you know, colonial histories or trans-Pacific histories earlier. But I think, you know, one result of this moment was James Velich's big book, Replenishing the Earth, about the settler revolution, about the relationship between the Eastern United States and the Western United States, in between Britain and its colonies, settler colonies, in the late 19th century. And Velich essentially makes this big argument about, you know, the unevenness of settler development, the fact that settler colonialism is kind of defined by these booms and busts, which is very true. You know, the economics of that, of settler colonialism, are definitely, you know, the economics of boom and bust. But I think that landscape photography and that photography in general actually has a really kind of interesting relationship to that pattern of boom and bust. And you know, I think maybe may even obscure some of the those economic conditions. The importance of photography, and this is clearest, I think, in the case of Watkins, who... you know, begins his career working on taking photographs on the surveys, you know, does a lot of work for mining companies, and then ends his career kind of promoting agricultural settlement in places like the Kern Valley. So the point of these huge photographic collections that end up being kind of produced by the 1880s, I think the function of them actually is to communicate a more reliable kind of reality. To communicate a more reliable, even reality than what the economic conditions actually were in the settler colonial American West and in the settler colonial kind of Tasman world. We know that, you know, there were huge movements of people and capital. We know that there were moments where people would rush into a site during the gold rushes and then rush out of it again. We know that as a result of that, there were whole economies that, you know, fell apart. But that's not necessarily the, you know, the clearest, that doesn't necessarily come across in some of the photography. And certainly it doesn't come across in the promotional photography that, you know, Watkins makes of irrigation in the Kern Valley. And in, you know, other photographers, it doesn't come across in the urban photography that's, you know, taking pictures of civic development. I think, you know, if I was to succinctly answer the question of what role landscape played in shaping settler colonialism in the West, is that it marketed it in a way that obscured some of the more complicated vulnerabilities of settler colonial development.
And on a similar note, I like to ask my guests after our discussion of the book to kind of put themselves in the shoes of one of their readers, thinking back on this book after finishing it, maybe a year later or 5 years later. What would you hope they remember from your book? Or maybe another way to put it is, what would one takeaway be that you hope your readers might recall from this book or might take with them from this book further into the future?
Yeah, so it's related to, you know, what I was just speaking about. You know, that what I'd like readers to take away is that, you know, a recognition that the settler revolution may have provided these settlers through the economic structure, with the economic structure through which kind of independent societies could be sustained. But the cultural work of establishing settler belonging in these places was a far more protracted and kind of intimate affair. And it relied on this work of photographers to discipline space, to partition actually the kind of threatening existence of Indigenous people from the environments that then settler belonging could be kind of articulated through. So not just the settler revolution, I suppose, is the, you know, not just the economics of the settler revolution, but also these kind of this long and ongoing cultural work that settler photographers did in order to create a feeling of belonging amongst their audiences.
And then finally, I always like to get a preview from my guests about what they're working on next. Sometimes it feels a little silly when the book has only been out for something like, I don't know, 5 months in the case of this book. But I know that historians and scholars in general always have a few projects that they're working on at a time. So what is coming down the pike from you next, Jared? What have you been working on while you've been completing this book and since it's been out?
Yeah, so I spoke about it earlier, my kind of interest in, you know, geology. So I've kind of followed, you know, that rabbit hole down. I've become really interested in surveyors and surveying. I've been reading a lot of survey reports since this book has come out. So I'm working on this new project, which I'm kind of calling Earth Science from the South, Surveying a Revolution in Geological History. As an environmental historian, I'm trying to kind of come at the history of science in a kind of different way. So the notable thing here is that I'm trying to understand the prehistory of plate tectonics, not via northern scientists and theorists, but via southern hemisphere surveyors and southern hemisphere places. So this project explains how the imperial search for coal, diamonds and other commodities preceded the mid-20th century breakthrough in geoscience that we now associate with the plate tectonic revolution. I think about these colonial surveyors, geologists and paleontologists. I'm thinking about them primarily as environmental thinkers, as theorists of past worlds and ecological orders. And so while these leading geoscientists in Europe and North America were relitigating old disputes over fieldwork and theory, the southern geologists were doing both. They were developing these new expansive thoughts about continental connection and environmental change over deep time. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. I'm trying to, write a new history of global geoscience, but from the south.
My dissertation advisor, who is also an environmental historian, liked to say that environmental history was great because on the one hand, you're studying history, but on the other hand, you get to study all sorts of other seemingly disparate fields while also studying history. And your current project sounds like a great example of that. It's about history, and it seems like an intellectual history, but it's also about geoscience and plate tectonics and the history of science as well. So that sounds like a fantastic project. I wish you luck on it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Jared Hoare is a postdoctoral fellow and co-director at the New Earth Histories Research Program at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and is the author of his new book, Visions of Nature: How Landscape Photography Shaped Settler Colonialism, which came out with the University of California Press in 2022. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Jared.
Thanks very much, Stephen.